Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking about fire and its place in the natural environment and how it is we think about it and how it is we cope with fires in wild lands. And our guest for the show in this hour, Stephen Pine, a man who has been called the world's leading historian of fire. He is the author of a number of books that deal with the matter, just among them, Fire, A Brief History, The Year of the Fires, A Story of the Great Fires of 1910, and then other books that have to do with the environment, including How the Canyon Became Grand, A Short History. He is the author of a new book that is just out. In fact, I'm really not quite sure that it's out on in the bookstores yet. A book titled Tending Fire, the subtitle Coping with America's Wildland Fires, in which he makes the argument that there are some problems with how it is we cope with wildland fires, and talks about how it is maybe we should be thinking differently about it and doing things a little bit differently. He is professor in the School of Life Sciences at Arizona State University, and in addition to being an academic and a writer, he is also a former firefighter for 15 seasons on the north rim of the Grand Canyon. He is joining us by telephone as we talk. Of course, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of people who call in is that they try to be brief, so that we can keep the program moving along and get in as many different people as possible. Questions welcome, though, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Professor Pine, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. And yourself?
I'm fine.
Thanks for talking with us again. We certainly appreciate it.
My pleasure.
I think that it's the case, I think that something you point out in the book is that, you know, if we go back, I don't think we have to go back probably too many years before we find that probably for most Americans, their awareness of wildfires not going to be very high, unless of course they happen to live in a place that where they're prone to fires. But now, within the past few years, certainly we're used to seeing news coverage of fires. We're used to seeing those aerial shots of fires, and we're seeing those little shots of planes and helicopters taken off with whatever it is they dump to dump on the fire, and you know, shots of people all suited up to go do it. So it's become now every summer. Now, it's a fairly regular standard news story, and it really wasn't. You don't have to go back too far to find out that it really wasn't. And I guess that might be one place we could start, and why it is that suddenly now it's fire is a story.
Well, that's a good question. I think there are several responses to that. One is we might go back again. You don't have to go very far in the past. Western fires, large eruptions of this sort, were treated roughly in the category of a grizzly bear attack. They were just sort of some freak of Western violence. They had very little to do with the rest of the country. Now they have become part of an annual media cycle. I think the explanations are several. One is the impact of the Yellowstone fires in 1988, which went on for weeks and sort of educated the national media, particularly television, about fire. And that started a process. Then that faded out. And then beginning 10 years ago with the 1994 season, had tremendous impact in the fire community, but also in the national media. And I think the connection there was that Norman MacLean had published posthumously a best-selling book, Young Men in Fire, and the 94 fire season, particularly the South Canyon fire that overran a group of firefighters, recapitulated the accounts of Young Men in Fire with eerie facsimile, and it suddenly alerted people to the fact that there might be some larger issues here, and it might be interesting. And then the big fire seasons have come with national election years. They've come every 2 years, 94, 96, 98, 2000, 2002. This year would be the exception. But that caused fire to get built into an electoral cycle as well. So I think there are a number of reasons why. There's also the fact that over the last decade, most of the West, the fire-prone areas of the country, have been in drought. And this has made fires more prominent. And we're also dealing with the legacy of our own misguided fire practices for more than a century, and that has created in many places a buildup of combustibles, of fuels that is aggravating the fire scene. And I think there's just a sense that it isn't working for all the drama. What we've been doing isn't really making progress to getting the land and the kinds of fires we want. And that has entered a larger discussion. And in a way, it's left the guild, the fire community, and becoming an object for broader conversations.
Mm. Well, it seems that for a long time, that the thinking about wildland fires was closely paralleled the way that we think about an urban fire. You know, the fire starts, you put it out, and that's that.
Yeah.
But it seems that there probably always were people who were questioning that, but it seems like in recent years that has come to be questions much more.
Well, that in some way is the fundamental question of what we do with fire, particularly on the public lands. When we set these lands aside, the idea was that they would be spared the kind of logging, land clearing, sort of scalping that had gone on in much of the country, and fires would go away because most of the bad fires people saw at the time, at the end of the 19th century, were caused by people. They were associated with railroads and land clearing and so forth, and that turned out not to be the case. So when they realized that fires weren't going away on their own, that they were a part of that natural system, then they would have to devise practices, institutions, policies, and partly because of the name, it's firefighting, they looked at the urban model and thought that would be it. So you want to control all the fires, and the way to do that is to get there as rapidly as possible, to find it and hit it as quickly as you can. And so for 50 years or so, that was the driving mechanism. And I think you're correct that the public has only really over the last decade or maybe since the Yellowstone fires become aware of the fallacies and liabilities of that approach, just basically a kind of paramilitary approach that we will literally fight fire. We will mass an army of counterforce and attack it. Become aware of that, but the fire community itself recognizes this several decades ago. I mean, policy began changing in the 1960s, and for some of agencies, like the National Park Service, have actually had a more varied or pluralistic fire policy for a longer period of time than they had a really aggressive fire suppression policy. So the policy business has been going on. That debate has been going on internally for a long time, and the question is not that we need to change the policy, but why hasn't the policy produced more results on the ground?
Something that I would expect a lot of people would have a hard time with, they would say that this was sort of counterintuitive, is the idea that fighting fires, aggressively fighting fires, mm-hmm. wildfires, would over the long term, and you know maybe in some cases depending on the conditions it wouldn't have to take that long, but over a period of time, that aggressively fighting them would lead to conditions that would make things worse,
yeah.
as time goes along. That is, you know, create conditions that would just have everything right in place so that you get the right conditions. Then over time you get even a bigger and bigger problem. And maybe you could talk about how that works.
Well, first of all, we can say again, now it's the historian speaking, that this is really a very old debate, and in some ways it's the founding debate. There was a question when these lands were set up, should we found our protection of the forest on fighting fires, that is trying to exclude them, or should we found it on lighting fires? And there was a large group and a rather vigorous group that argued we should emulate the American Indian. We should emulate many of people living on the land who regularly burned many of these landscapes, not all of them. And by doing so, they kept sort of the woody scrub, all the combustibles that would grow and pile up on the forest floor, they kept that under control. So regular burning was a kind of spring cleaning, if you will. It was like small floods that would clean out a watershed regularly, as opposed to sort of giant floods that would scour it out. And the argument was very vigorously debated even a century ago, and was hard fought. It became politicized, and for a variety of reasons, we adopted sort of the aggressive suppression approach. But we were warned. The critics actually said, you know, if you do this, you're going to build up combustibles, you're going to have fires you can't control, you're going to have diseased, insect-ridden forests, they're going to be overgrown, they're going to be starved, they're going to be in miserable shape, you'll regret it, and in fact, all those forecasts were in fact correct. So this is an old debate, and the fact, I mean, there are several things you can say. Why? How does this work? One thing is that, you know, it's a living system. It's not like a city. It's not, stuff doesn't burn because we build it there. It grows. It's constantly changing. And in the arid or semi-arid West, there is very little biological decomposition of this material. It's not like a tropical rainforest where very little survives on the floor because there are organisms to decompose it. It's going to sit there. It's going to sit there for a long time. So that stuff is, something has to get rid of it at some point. And there's a biological argument that many of the nutrients, perhaps critical nutrients like phosphorus in the system, get locked up in this large woody debris, and something has to break it out and recycle it. It's as though nature's economy, people are putting all their money in socks and sticking it in mattresses. It needs to get into circulation. It needs to flow, and fire is part of what keeps that flowing. Well, I think what we've learned is that fire can be just as powerful removed as applied, and that systems which are used to a regular pattern of fire or some pattern of fire, if you change that pattern, they become upset. That's a disturbance. That can be as profound a disturbance as putting fire into a system that isn't used to it. If I could, one last point on this that I think is important. It's not, we tend to argue, well, fire or not fire. That's really a misstatement. What we should be talking about is the pattern of fire or fire's regime, because it's saying that something's adapted to fire is like saying it's adapted to water. It's adapted to a particular pattern of rainfall of summer and winter, snow and rain. And it matters whether the rain comes the same every month or whether it's all in 2 months. So the same thing with fire. The system has accommodated itself to certain rhythms and organizations of fire on the land. If you change that pattern, then they are no longer adapted. So it's not just whether you have fire or not. It's the kind of fire.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Stephen Pine. He's professor in the School of Life Sciences at Arizona State University and has written a lot about fire in nature, and has a new book out. It's titled Tending Fire, Coping with America's Wildland Fires, and it's published by Island Press, and has written a number of others about that deal with things like fire in the history of the world, a particular book that we talked about when it came out a couple of years ago about 1 year in American history that it was a big year of fire, and how that contributed to the way people think about fire, and also has written a book about the Grand Canyon, which is titled How the Canyon Became Grand, and a number of others. So if you're interested, you can certainly head out to the library or to the bookstore and look for some of his writing. And of course, questions are welcome too. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And we have a couple of people here with questions. We'll go to Belgium, Illinois, nearby, line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning, all. Mm-hmm. Start off with, that was 1988? I thought it was 1987 that the Yellowstone fire was. I remember being there, and I could have sworn it was 87, summer of 87. But that's another story. The question I was going to ask you about is, you were talking about historical fires. The grandson of the namesake of a small town near here called Danville wrote stories, historical facts, about the prairie fires that used to run across the Midwest here. that were very much effect of the environment. In other words, the prairie needed to burn, and in the process, when it burned across, it'd start forest fires and also start house fires and whatever other kind of fires it could start. I was wondering if you discussed that, because that's when a lot of these thoughts about fire were changing, you know, in the late 1900s, like 1880, 1870. They had huge fires that would run across the prairies for long periods of time.
Well, a couple of good questions there. One, it was 1988 for Yellowstone, and that was also the year that the world became alerted to large fires in the Amazon. And so there was a sense of the whole world is somehow about to be consumed by flame. The prairie fire situation is a great story, perhaps not as well known as it might be. What eliminated the prairie fires fundamentally was simply the act of settlement, that you began putting in roads, you began plowing fields, you began protecting your wheat and your harvested crops from fires coming out from elsewhere. And the simple act of converting the land from wild prairie to domesticated farmland pretty much strangled fire out of the landscape. But during that transition period, it could be very dangerous. And there are lots of wonderful accounts of this stuff during that period. But what's particularly interesting is in places like Illinois, the Prairie Peninsula, the Tallgrass Prairie, is that if fire did not burn there, then in relatively short order, woody vegetation began moving in. The system began converting, shifting into a kind of forest or woodland. So you had to have a lot of fire, regular fire, but it's also naturally divided up by lots of streams and broken terrain. And so you would have had to have a lot of fires in each one of these patches to keep that amount going. And the only way you can do that is if people were doing it. So at that point, we're not simply dealing with a, quote, natural system. And the story is not simply one of our having intervened, taken fires that nature put in, taken those fires out, and are now facing the penalty. It's very likely that many of these systems had adapted to a period of human burning, the patterns of burning that had been laid down for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. And removing those fires could be just as upsetting to the system as not. And this is something the fire community is still grappling with, because they've been dazzled by a sort of wilderness vision that fire is natural, and so we need to restore it. They're having a harder time coping with the idea that maybe much of what we set out to preserve and the fires, the pattern of fires, the regime that these landscapes require, is one that people were responsible for. So there's a philosophical argument there that translates into practical questions of what do you do?
If I might point out, one thing you didn't mention that really stopped the prairie fires was barbed wire. What the original prairie settlers would do is they would build themselves some sort of a house. And the first thing they would do is they'd put a large fence around the outside and have the cattle eat the prairie. And then they would increase the fence bigger, start farming the inside, and allow the cattle to eat the outside farther out, keeping the grass farther away from the valuable property. It was kind of an interesting technique how they did that. And also, in various discussions, they would talk how these fires would come across the prairie and just light the entire sky. But in the process, they would consume, like you say, entire woods, 300-400 acres of woods, and just bingo, no time whatsoever. Thank you very much, sir.
Well, thank you.
Let's go to another caller here. This is Indiana, line one. Hello.
Hello. This is one of those programs that I know next to nil about in terms of fire, so I hope this question isn't particularly off the record, too stupid. But the first thing that came to my mind when it was mentioned what was going to be on was that analogically here in the Midwest, particularly in the Mississippi, there's been a great pressure to try to get people off the lowlands so that we don't have to be too much concerned about human life when the Mississippi decides to flood. And I remember sometimes in the past I've seen firefighters dropping in places that, you know, seemed to me from, you know, the Western movies, you know, way out in the boondocks to save people who were on the sides of mountains who'd built a home, and that you'd have to go several miles to find another group of people that were building in those places. And I'm not too much knowledgeable about the parts of California where they seem to, you know, wipe out a small section of, I guess it's suburbia in some sense, but I just wondered about the part of human life plays in responding to whether we let her burn or whether we jump in with 8,000 guys and put them at risk to save a couple of homes. Thank you.
Well, that's a great question. The dominant question of the fire community for the last, oh, say, 15 years or so has been exactly the problem you're pointing to, which is to say this proliferation of houses and developments in kind of wildland settings. And it's known locally as the wildland-urban interface. I find it an awkward expression, but I also think it's limiting because it doesn't capture how much is going on in the east and south and Florida and the rest, where it's not wildland, it's sort of former agricultural land. And you can think of it, I think of it now as an act, we're recolonizing what had been rural America. We're doing it with houses. So it's like the old frontier, except converting it to farms, we're converting it to subdivisions. And in the process, we're coming into and creating whole new fire problems, which we didn't think we would have to deal with again. At what point do we decide houses are indefensible, that the hazards are too great? Those are questions that are not simply limited to fire. We can look at floods, as you pointed out, but there are hazards all over the place. Look at hurricane hazards more recently. Look at coastal construction. I mean, there seems to be no way to stop people from building where they want to do. And those constructions, those developments will interbreed with whatever natural hazards are out there. And in the West, fire is a major natural hazard, so we see it and it's dramatic. But it seems to me this is really a national problem. And at that point, it's almost not even a fire problem. It's a problem with how we are going to settle or recolonize our landscape. But that has been a driving issue for, as I say, the last 15 years or so. And a lot of effort good effort has gone into trying to cope with that.
Well, again, we're here at our midpoint. We have time for other calls if people have questions. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. So that's good for anybody anywhere that can hear us, or if you're listening on the Internet, you can do that. As long as you're in the United States, you can use that number. And again, our guest is Stephen Pine. He's a professor in the School of Life Sciences at Arizona State University. You were talking a little earlier, Professor Pine, about fire and its place in the environment and the fact that it has a role, always has, and that maybe one of the mistakes that we have made is we have eliminated its natural role. At the same time, I can imagine there are some people who would say that, you know, you can talk about controlled burning, but it's maybe easier said than done, and it's a dangerous and unpredictable thing. And we'll point to examples where a fire was intentionally set. I'm not talking about arson, but it was set in a way to achieve some of this kind of controlled burning that got out of hand, and then suddenly we had a big problem. And do we really understand fire enough, well enough, and do we have the means to actually have a controlled burn and make sure that it doesn't get out of control and suddenly we have a huge fire on our hands that's something that's way bigger than we can possibly control?
Yeah. Well, you know, when the fire community in the late 60s began to realize that fire exclusion had been a mistake, and I use that not simply fire suppression. It's not just that nature set fires and we put them out. It's that we quit lighting fires. But fire disappeared from the landscape. When they realized that was a problem, the solution seemed to be simply to put fire back in, and then it would all become good again. And we've discovered that's a lot more difficult than we thought. And particularly where landscapes have changed over several decades, fire will synthesize whatever its surroundings are. And if those surroundings have changed, you're going to get a different kind of fire. And it's not going to be as easy to control as you thought say, based on historic evidence. In many ways, it's more like reintroducing a lost species. In a sense, you have to create a habitat so that fire will do what you want. Where I live, we used to have Mexican gray wolves. We don't have them anymore. They're being reintroduced in some of the remote mountains, but introducing them into, say, Arrowhead Mall would probably not be a good idea. They're not going to behave as they would before. And that's what we've learned with fire. It will take on its character from that context. So you're right. We've had some spectacular failures. We've had some successes, but we've had a lot of failures. Probably the best known being the one that escaped and burned into Los Alamos in 2000. Mm-hmm. But we ought to remember that the National Park Service, which had set that fire, also set a fire on the north rim of Grand Canyon, which blew up at the same time and forced the evacuation of that area. And that episode's been overshadowed by the Los Alamos fiasco. But suddenly you've got two incidents, and it begins to look not like a single act of carelessness or misjudgment, but something systemic, that we're determined to put fire back in, whether the conditions are right or not. There are many areas where putting fire back in can work. There are many areas where it's going to be necessary. In effect, we can restore fire, but our fire, not just whatever arson or nature allows, but it's going to be expensive and difficult, and I think we're learning it's dangerous as well.
We have some other folks here to talk with, or at least one other caller here to talk with here in Urbana, where we are. Line one.
Excellent program. I want the speaker to talk a little bit about the distinction between chaparral fires, such as the famous Cedar Fire about a year ago out in San Diego, and forest fires, because it turns out that apparently all the spilling over of people into the chaparral in the San Diego County have created lots of problems, both in terms of starting fires but also in suppressing them, because the firefighters have to spend a lot of time defending property instead of managing, if you would, the fire. And that fires in chaparral apparently convert the chaparral from chaparral to a grassland, which further extirpates a lot of species in San Diego County. There's a lot of threatened and endangered species that are threatened by this management, if you would, of fires in an area where they weren't normally very frequent.
No, a couple points that are worth emphasizing. One is we need to, we're calling all this wildland fire, mm-hmm. but you can have fire in tall grass prairie, you can have it in chaparral, you can have it in ponderosa pine, you can have it in lodgepole. The typical kinds of fires or the fire regime that each of those has is different.
Yeah.
And so they require different responses. We need to think differently about them. In some areas where fire is necessary, the typical fire may be a stand replacing. That is one that simply kills everything above ground, say lodgepole pine. So there's no way we can eliminate fire there without destroying all the things that fire does. We're going to have a high-intensity fire. And some of the chaparral fires are going to burn in that way as well. I still think there are some things we can do about that, but we need to be very careful that the techniques that may be suited for one environment aren't going to work in others.
Absolutely.
What may work on a north-facing side of a hill isn't going to work on the south-facing side of the same hill. You have to be very site-specific. That means it's very tough to deal with. And as far as, again, going back to the houses and the rest, you know, we're having to divert lots of resources, but I'm not trying to absolve the situation there, but we're having to divert all kinds of resources for where we're building houses all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
Inappropriately, the particular scene, the Cedar Fire in San Diego. I did have a chance to see that about a month after the fire, and the striking thing there was the dramatic border between the chaparral, the sort of rolling hillsides, the Santa Ana winds behind it,
the
kind of storm surge of flame hitting the housing development on the hills. But you know, the only houses that went were those that had wooden roofs.
Mm-hmm.
You could go right down afterwards along that storm surge front. If it had shake shingle roofs, it burned. If it didn't, it survived.
We saw them too, and you're absolutely right.
I mean, so it's not that suddenly this is so complicated we can't deal with it. Or even if we're going to put houses where perhaps we shouldn't, there are still fairly simple devices that have been known for a long time. And we've known that combustible roofs burn houses. We've known that for 10,000 years. This is not new knowledge. It's just a case of making it stick.
Yeah, right. The problem is the planners don't have the political or financial clout to make the developers make fireproof roofs, if you would.
Yeah. And in fact, there were. It was fascinating because there were roofs there that looked very much like shake shingle that are actually tile.
Right.
So you can get the aesthetic effect, but it's not going to burn your house down.
Yep, you're correct. Well,
this is a dumb problem to have, by the way, because it has technical solutions like changing roofing material.
Certainly.
Whereas what to do in Yellowstone or nature reserves, who knows what the right solution is.
Most of the mountain cabins probably should be fireproofed in a sense that it doesn't take a whole lot of effort to keep the fire from burning them.
Yeah.
And that's not being done either.
Well, I think that there are changes. I mean, I think that new stuff, people have got the word. I'm a believer. I've seen it, the conversion going on. The real difficulty is that you've got, say, 25 or 30 years of bad construction. And how are you going to retrofit it?
Yeah.
That, and so what we're going to see, I think, is less the new housing being hit in the same way as the old housing being cleaned out by a series of fires unless you can get ahead of that curve.
A good example, though, is that houses are often re-roofed every 10 to 20 years and simply requiring the new re-roof to be of a fireproof type would over a period of time resolve that problem quite a bit.
Yeah, that's right. And then you just have to take your chances during that reconstruction period, and that seems to me not an unreasonable gamble.
Good.
All right. Well,
thanks
for the call. Thanks very much. Next caller is in Ogden and our line two. Hello.
Hi. I'm enjoying your program very much. You may have covered the question I have just recently, but My question is, would you compare the nature and role, the ecological role of fire in a western forest with, say, the role of fire in an eastern deciduous forest like the Ozarks, for example? And I'll just hang up and listen.
Okay. Wow. Well, fire does lots of different things in different places, and there are many eastern forests that are extremely fire-prone and in many ways fire-dependent. Perhaps the most celebrated, the poster child, would be the longleaf pine on the coastal plain of the southeast. Many of the old deciduous forests, maple, say, hemlock and so forth in the northeast and the rest, are not fire-adapted. They do not have fire built into their system. But if you look at the New England area, what you see is that there is the precipitation month by month is pretty much the same. It may change from snow, sleet, rain, but it's constant. What you need for fire is a pattern of wetting and drying. So it has to be wet enough to grow stuff and then dry enough to allow that to burn. And the West has that cycle, so you have a natural basis for fire that you don't have in the Northeast. The Ozarks are interesting. There have been some studies, actually by researchers in Missouri, who have looked at some of the fire history there. And it's interesting, too, because of the human element and sort of the inextricable character of people being fire agents directly and indirectly in shaping that land and keeping fire in there. Whereas in much of the West, even though people did burn and so forth, there is generally enough lightning that sooner or later it will burn in one way or another. And there are some great stories from the Ozarks when areas were set aside as national forests and other places. The local people were all furious at being denied fire and would go out surreptitiously and burn it. They would talk about lighting, soaking a rope in gasoline, lighting it, and then galloping with that lit rope behind a horse to try to get some fire back in before the whole landscape changed into something that was uninhabitable.
A little bit earlier, you noted the fact that there has been reporting on fire in the Amazon. Maybe not lately, but mm-hmm. but there has. And I'm curious because it does seem to me that we do now that the Western fire story is one that we see fairly regularly in the American news over the last few years. But I don't recall seeing a lot of reporting about wildfires anyplace else. And I'm assuming that there are other places where it does occur, but I guess I wonder, are there places that parallel in conditions that parallel the West outside of the United States, and do they think differently about fire than we do?
Well, you're really coming to the core of a lot of my own research, which has been comparative studies of how people in places interact with fire around the world. There are several answers. One is that for the year 2000, an estimate was made of how much fire there was on the planet using remote sensing. In the U.S., at about 3.5 million hectares estimated burned, which at that time just seemed staggering. You know, where has this come from? We haven't seen this for 60 years, et cetera. Globally, about 350 million hectares burned, which is to say the U.S. had roughly 1%. The global fire load. You don't hear about that. We're actually a fire sink relative to our land, relative to historic fires. I mean, we have a huge fire deficit compared with others. Now, part of the fires that are elsewhere are the result of similar kinds of conditions to ours. Say, think of countries with large wildlands, back countries, similar histories, Australia, Canada, Russia. And most of it, however, is embedded in some kind of agricultural system, some kind of slash-and-burn cultivation, some kind of pastoralism, huge amounts in Africa, for example, burning grasslands and so forth. And it would be an enormous mistake to simply take the institutions, policies, and attitudes that are suitable for one and try to apply it to the others. But, you know, these television scenes with these huge sky cranes dumping water and you know, aircraft fighting fires and the rest. That's what they want. That's the last thing they probably need. You need to organize your patterns of rural burning and smooth it out. There are also interesting cases. We could go on this, but they've encountered very similar stories, very similar kinds of problems. The whole effort to install firefighting in the U.S. was really, in the 19th century, was part of a global movement, a global conservation movement. And European nations were doing it all over their colonies, and the U.S. really emulated them, in particular the British in India.
On again to another caller here in Terre Haute over in Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Hi.
Hello. Mm-hmm.
I understand the various federal agencies canceled the large air tanker contracts this year, and I think it probably wasn't too well thought out, but I just wondered what your opinion is of the result of that, and what do you believe will happen in the future regarding large air tankers?
Oh boy, large air tankers. I think the agencies were correct in canceling the contracts because they could not verify the maintenance history of these, and many of these aircraft were left over from World War II. I mean, many of them should have been in museums rather than flying, and there were problems. Probably the timing was not very smart doing that just in the cusp of fire season. But I think there's an opportunity here to rethink what kind of aerial support do you want. And helicopters work very well in many areas. Large air cranes work very well in certain areas. There's certainly a case for very small as opposed to large air tankers, single-engine air attack planes, converted agricultural planes with relatively small load but can make first attack. They can get there quickly. Get some water or retardant on a fire, hold it until ground crews can come. There's a real place for a kind of cheap swarm of small aircraft that can do that. And there's going to be a place for large aircraft, but I think it's a fairly small one. There are two versions right now of competing versions of giant aircraft. One is converting 747s. And when I heard that, I thought they were absolutely nuts, but apparently they're able to do some demos and make it work. And the other are the Russians, who have a couple of giant aircraft, including a swept-wing jet, the Ilyushin 76, which could probably drop enough water in one salvo to flatten a small community. And there may be places where these kinds of air tankers are useful. My own sense is that I would prefer smaller aircraft and part of an initial attack, that once fires become large, really large, and roaring with a good wind behind them, there is not much you can do. And you're really, it's just sort of political theater to send fleets of air tankers up and have them drop stuff. It's good television, but it's not really making an effect. So I would put my money in those situations on a fleet of smaller aircraft where you can get initial attack, and then maybe think about some large helicopters, medium to large helicopters, to protect the urban fringe, because you can maneuver better. With some night vision and avionics, you could probably fly at night here, and you can get the water exactly where you want it. And that, if I had to make those decisions, that's where I would put my money.
Well, what is the status of the 747 that Evergreen has been modeled?
Well, they're still investigating, and in fact, it's actually down the road from where I live now, Marana. They've been trying and filming it, and apparently, to the critics and my surprise, they're having some success. Whether it could actually be loosed in a mountainous country, and you're flying 200 feet above the trees with a 747, I don't know whether they can make the whole thing work. I'm not sure how much need there is. There would probably, one could imagine, if you will, a need for half a dozen large aircrafts on a global scale that could go to different parts of the world as different fire seasons. I mean, the northern and southern hemispheres are out of sync in terms of fire season, so you could imagine these things just sort of migrating globally in the way that we have a national air tanker fleet around the country. I don't know what's going to happen with that. I think they're getting close to the point of actually doing some field trials probably by next summer. There might be places, for example, if you wanted in Alaska where you have large, relatively level or low rolling hills where you could use it. I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, very interesting. Thank you.
All right, thank you. It seems that whenever you have a big fire and things go wrong and people are killed, the same sort of questions are asked, and we say the same stories, and there's a lot of criticism leveled at the fire service, and it has been happening recently, fairly recently, because of questions about a fire that occurred in the summer of 2003 in Idaho, where it seemed like there were a lot of bad decisions. People were killed. And questions were raised about, does the fire service, do they know what they're doing? And then do they really have the tools to do the job that they're being given to do? What about that? I mean, we've talked about the fact that maybe we're taking the wrong approach, but even with the approach we're taking, do the people that we have given this job to, have we given them the tools to come anywhere close to being able to do it without putting their people in such danger that we have situations like this where people die because they're in the middle of fires and suddenly things go wrong and things happen that you don't expect, and you know, it doesn't take very long for people to die.
Yeah, I think you're just going to have to accept the fact that firefighting is a dangerous business, and you know, you want to do it as safely as you can, but there are just inherent risks, and people will have to. At some point, they will have to accept. If you choose, you're not being conscripted for this. You're volunteering, and at some point, you have to accept those. I would say that the U.S. has fallen behind over the last decade, maybe 20 years, in the technologies of firefighting. We have some whiz-bang stuff, But I don't think it's fundamentally changed how we go about fighting fires or getting the mix of things that we need. And I would be happy to have a kind of rechartering, if you will, the technological base of fire, and thinking about not simply adding new stuff to the mix, but remaking the mix. How do we really want to do it? How many people? Do we really need tens of thousands of people being shipped out to this, or can we do it with a lot smaller group? Can we use technology? Where and when do we have to have people? Where can we pull back? Really, at a fundamental level, do that. And you have to do that well in advance of fire season. You can't expect people with these kinds of responsibilities to make decisions instantly when the fires are racing towards a town or whatever. This has to be done well in advance. I think also that the flip side of that is that we have not really come up with a good auditing system for fire. And I think of something, it's only in the last 10 years that OSHA even began considering this as a workplace environment and has begun contributing some analysis to it. I would think we need something like the National Transportation Safety Board or whatever, some third party to come in and investigate. It's always been the case that the fire community has investigated itself, and while they certainly try hard and are well-intentioned, inevitably there's going to be a conflict of interest as to who is appointed, what report comes out, how do the agencies look. There is really no independent, truly independent auditor making those decisions, and I don't think we can expect the agencies to do that on their own. I would think there's a case to be made for creating an investigative body that can then make policy decisions and the rest independent of the internal politics of the agencies.
Yeah. Well, if we go back to some of the issues we were talking about earlier and about the fact that I think you argued, I think the fact the last time we talked you said really the problem is that we're still going between the two extreme poles when it comes to fires. That is, either we got to fight them or we got to light them, one or the other. And that I think you argued then and are still arguing that there's something in the middle, and that's really where we should be. I mean, what would a more rational kind of wildland fire policy look like?
I think you have basically four options. And we're talking about public land, and we're talking about public land that is fire-prone. I think you can let it burn, and back off, and let fire have more ground. You can try to suppress it. You can try to do the burning yourself. That's the fighting and lighting contrast. And I think you can try to change the combustibility of the landscape. That is to say, regardless of the source of the fire will take on certain traits because of what it's burning. And a fire is very different in a way from a flood or a hurricane or whatever. It's not just a physical disturbance. It's propagated through a biological medium. If you don't have those living organisms, those hydrocarbon fuels out there, the fire doesn't burn, where a flood will go regardless whether there's anything or not. So there's a real opportunity to intervene in the medium that carries the fire, in the landscape itself. Now, you need to do this with some sense and sensibility. You need to agree what you want the landscape to be, and that's where the political wall is hit. But otherwise, I think it's sort of like a game of rock, scissors, paper. You're just sort of chasing yourself endlessly around. And at least in a limited way, intervening and to change the combustibility gives you an option of another degree of control. No one of those four options, by the way, is going to work by itself. You need mixtures of them, and it's all going to be different place by place. It's a lot of hard work, a lot of negotiations to try to make this work. But I think that's where you have to go, and you have to have social consensus as to why you want to do that, and then you have to have enough political will and sustained funding to really make it happen. And, much of the reforms, the proposals that came out for trying this, at least selectively, were a few years ago when we were in a budget surplus and appeared to have large surpluses. Now we have enormous deficits. And frankly, faced with a choice between prescribed fires or prescription drugs, I'm pretty confident where Congress is going to vote. So I think in that case, the future does not look great. I think we can begin handling some of this wildland-urban interface thing. We're already making steps towards that. I think we can selectively improve areas elsewhere. I think free-burning fire is going to be rather like an endangered species. It's going to retreat into special preserves and habitats where it does work that nothing else does. It's biological work. We have to have it there. We have to make room for it. But otherwise, I think the near future, and indeed perhaps the long future, is to see it recede, leach away from most of the American landscape, and we seem to be content to pour chemicals or do other things to replace it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think at that, we're probably going to have to stop. For people who would like to read more on the subject, our guest, Stephen Pine, has authored a number of books, this most recent, that sets out some of the same issues that we've been discussing here this morning as Tending Fire, Coping with America's Wildland Fires. And that's published by the Island Press. And, of course, he has a number of others, including this kind of global historical look at fire and its place in the environment. More than one book that deals with that, some others. So you can look at the library, look at the bookstore. Stephen Pine, he's professor in the School of Life Sciences at Arizona State University. And Professor Pine, thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.